end this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, a conversation with Society for the Rule of Law Institute Board President George Conway. We talk about the organization and its mission. Then, we speak with Ben and Ben Teleblu, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He talks about Iran's role in the Israel-Hamas war and the state of U.S. relations with Iran. Plus, Krish Amara Vignaraja, President and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, talks about U.S. immigration policy and the asylum process.
Before we get to this week's episode, we want to take a minute to ask you for your help. Your financial support will ensure that C-SPAN can continue to produce podcasts that inform you about national politics, introduce you to the latest nonfiction books, and provide valuable historical context to today's news. Make a donation today and be a part of C-SPAN's future. Visit cspan.org/donate.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
First, a conversation with Society for the Rule of Law Institute Board President George Conway.
Lawyer, columnist, social media must-follow George Conway is adding a new title these days. It's board president of the Society for the Rule of Law Institute. Mr. Conway, what's the mission of the new group? How do you go about accomplishing that mission?
Well, the mission is to promote the rule of law and to protect the rule of law and at a time when it is seriously under threat. I mean, we have a likely presidential nominee in the Republican Party who basically will forsake the rule of law, who's basically promising that he wants to use the government, should he become president again, as an instrument for his revenge against his enemies. It's a very, very much almost a third world country kind of thing that we're seeing. And we want to get the message out about what the dangers are that we face and about how important it is that the rules be respected, the rule of law be respected, that the rules governing representative democracy be respected, and to get people to understand what's at stake.
Who's we? Are these all lawyers like yourself?
Yeah, well, there's a group of us who are the core members who formed the group once under a different name in 2018, that long ago. And then we've sort of revitalized the organization for this year because, you know, we didn't think we would be here in 2023 with a presidential candidate under indictment in four places with 91 counts against him. And after he tried to incite an insurrection, we didn't think that, you know, our mission was going to be necessary after Donald Trump went on the airplane and finally conceded the election after trying to, you know, raid Capitol Hill like that. So we are back, and this is more of a long-term effort because there seems to be a problem. It's not just one person anymore. It seems to be a problem throughout the country at various levels of government and among the public where they don't understand what America means, which is we resolve our differences peacefully and through the ballot box. We don't engage in conspiracy theories. We look at facts and we look at reality, and we just think that it's time to go back to basics. It's in part a longer term civil education civics program.
You wouldn't say it's a group that's defined by its opposition to Donald Trump.
It that's one of many facets of it. I mean, we're not a campaign group. We're not a PAC. We're not here to tell people who to vote for and how to vote and that type of thing. We're here to talk about what's at stake, and we're here to talk about the values that we think make America special and that have made America special to the world, and that are under threat and that we risk losing if people don't appreciate the significance of what's at stake.
Is there a legal component to what you're going to be doing?
Yes, there will be a legal component. We do hope to and will, I'm sure, file amicus briefs in litigation that is pertinent to the issues, whether it involve the potential Republican nominee or not. And we certainly, because we are an organization of lawyers, we're going to be going out and talking to law schools, law students, and we're going to form chapters of grown-up lawyers out in the country to talk to bar associations to really get those voices out to be heard. And we're also, we'll also have there'll be ways for people who are non-lawyers to participate, because in a sense they're the audience. But we want this to be a broad-based, long-term effort to really help reestablish the values that I think, that made this country great.
As folks are calling in, you mentioned an organization of lawyers. Remind people what the Federalist Society is.
Yeah, the Federalist Society is an organization that I have been a long-time member of. I was a member of the board of the Board of Visitors of the Federalist Society. I joined the Federalist Society in 1984 or 85 when I was a first-year law student. And it was an organization that was very important at the time, and still I think is important, because most of the legal establishment, especially it was in the 70s and 80s, and from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, is very, very liberal. It was very monolithic in its political views. And, the feeling was then, and I felt strongly about it, and I still do, was that people on the left had come too much to rely on judges to affect social policy, and that's not the function of the courts, and began to read things into the Constitution that, I might agree with them if I were a legislator. It is not something for judges to do, and there are many threads to the Federal Society. There are traditional conservatives, there are libertarians, but it's really, people think of it as some kind of a secret mafia or secret society. It's not really that. It's really kind of a debating club, and a networking enterprise where people can meet each other and who have like views, where they didn't really have any place else to go, because if you go to all these legal groups that existed, they were all liberal, and today. The mission is different. The function is different. The Federal Society, because it doesn't really take positions on things, isn't in a position where it can say where it can take strong stances on things.
Should it have taken a position when it came to Donald Trump or post January 6th?
I don't think it's the role of the Federal Society to be for or against Donald Trump. I understand that. What I will say is that if the shoe had been on the other foot, if you will, and a Democratic or liberal president had incited an insurrection and suggested that the Constitution be terminated, and all of the things, and basically talking about how he's going to use the government if elected again for retribution, and had stolen classified documents, and had been attacking the courts, and had been become an adjudicated rapist by a United States District Court. I mean, if a Democrat had done that, I think we would have seen more debate and discussion and programming on that, not necessarily advocacy of a position, because it's not a political, it's not a PAC, but we would have seen wall-to-wall programming on that. And I think the problem from the Federal Society standpoint is that it represents a cross-section of people on the right. Some people are virulently feel the way I do about the current situation. Others are MAGA, and others are just, trying not to get hit in the crossfire. So it's not really an organization that was built with or is currently structured to be able to deal with this threat, which is, I think, much more significant and much more important then what issues may divide us on how to interpret particular clauses of the Constitution or what legal policies are better or worse. I mean, this is just more fundamental. This is the whole ball of wax, and it's something that should unite everyone regardless of their political persuasion.
That was Society for the Rule of Law Institute Board President George Conway. Next, we talk with Benham Bentaleblou, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
A focus now on Iran and the ongoing crisis in the Middle East. Benham Bentaleblou is an Iranian security political issues expert at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And Mr. Taliblu, explain first the role Iran's been playing amid the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas. What do they think they can gain amid this crisis?
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. The Islamic Republic is leveraging its regional strategy. It's created or co-opted a whole series of proxy terror groups across the multiple battlefields in the Middle East that we see today, battlefields that used to have U.S. force partners, battlefields that used to have U.S. forces themselves, some places that still have U.S. forces operating. And in all of these jurisdictions, it's got one element of a terror group that has a certain kind of capability: drones, rockets, missiles, mortars, IRAMs, things of that nature. And what Iran is doing now in the post-October 7 space, as Israel is continuing to fight Hamas in Gaza and moving further south, is that it's slowly leveraging this network that they themselves call the axis of resistance, or Mehvat Moghavamat in Persian, as they like to say. And they bring elements of this axis online to create a conflict spiral in the hopes of preventing Israel from being able to finish off Hamas. And in some cases, these proxies are attacking the Israelis, or what they believe is Israeli-linked shipping or Israeli-linked interests, as the Houthis, Iran's proxy in Yemen, are doing. And in other areas, they're trying to take advantage of U.S. risk aversion in places like Iraq and Syria by stepping up the rate of fire there. There's been about a reported 74, 75 attacks on the U.S. force presence there, all by Iran-backed militias in Iraq and Syria. And the goal there is to get the U.S. to run towards the conflict between Hamas and Israel and create a deconfliction agreement, much like the 1973 deconfliction agreements between the Arabs and the Israelis. And in the hopes of the Iranians being able to do this, they're trying to use violent ends to achieve a political means.
When we say Iran-backed, what do we mean? Is that just money? Is that money and training? Is that Iranian military officials being embedded in some of these groups? What does that term mean?
It's broadly material and political support, and you can unpack material in two major ways. They're not the only ways, but they're two important ways to understand how Iran creates, co-ops, but ultimately controls this axis of resistance. It's money on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's weapons. And then the maintenance, training, logistics, liaising with other elements of Iran's terror apparatus, liaising with Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, liaising with the Quds Force, the elite foreign operations branch of that. So there's the material support and then the political support, the consistent political cover, diplomatic cover that Iran also provides these proxies. One example, of course, that is a game changer and worth noting is that right into the lead-in of the Thanksgiving holiday, for the first time ever, the Iran-backed militias in Iraq fired a ballistic missile. Different trajectory, different speed than, of course, rockets, mortars, and drones, which the Iran-backed militias in Iraq were firing at us since 2019. So Iran is able to escalate by introducing a different kind of weaponry that it provides to these groups, and that is one example of material support.
Where did that ballistic missile go?
That ballistic missile targeted, I believe, a U.S. base in northern Iraq. Fortunately, no U.S. fatalities. But I think, unfortunately, given Iran's capability and intent to continue to fire, it may only be a matter of time before there is a major injury beyond the traumatic brain injuries that have been reported, about 59 total brain injuries so far. But I fear that this is set to continue.
So drill in on the significance of this attack from over the weekend on from Yemen on commercial shipping in the Red Sea, and also a U.S. Navy vessel engaging here.
So these are a few different elements at play that Iran is trying to bring together. Element one is, of course, Iran's material support to the Houthis. The Houthis are far actually outdated in terms of their historical significance and their presence in Yemen. They're much, much older than the Islamic Republic, but the Islamic Republic co-opted this group through material support, through political support. And in 2014, 2015, when these actors overtook Sana'a, overtook the country, ousted the government, and continued to fight a Saudi-backed coalition, more and more Iranian weaponry came in. Land attack cruise missiles, drones, short-range ballistic missiles, and now medium-range ballistic missiles, anti-ship ballistic missiles, anti-ship cruise missiles. The Houthis are the only proxy of Iran to have used anti-ship ballistic missiles, most recently in this attack over the weekend, as well as the only proxy of Iran to have medium-range ballistic missiles. This means ballistic missiles that can fly over 1,000 kilometers. These are changes to the way we need to look at Iran's apparatus of terror in the region. In 2017, for example, the Houthis talked about their intent to enter a conflict against Israel, either with Lebanese Hezbollah on their side or either with the Palestinians on their side, but they did not yet have the capability. As of 2019, the Houthis have had that capability, and as of 2023, they've had that capability to begin to fire at Israel, which is over 1,000 kilometers away from Yemen. When you add in the shipping component, which is part of a larger Israel-Iran shadow war, there has been one direct attack by Iran using a drone against Israeli-linked commercial shipping. This is part of this larger shadow war between Israel and Iran we've seen with cyber attacks on ports, attacks on shipping, as well as attacks on critical infrastructure that both countries have tried to use to adjudicate their larger strategic competition in the Middle East. The Iranians, obviously, when they chant death to Israel, they mean it, and now they're showing you with the material support that they have the capability to act on it.
Staying on the Houthis for a second, from the Washington Times today, I just want to get your thoughts on this analysis of this piece on the naval attacks. Specialists warn that the Houthis are something of a wild card and don't necessarily abide by the same cost-benefit analysis that drives the decision-making of other Iran-affiliated groups such as Hezbollah and the Iraqi militias, which have engaged in sharp but more limited confrontations with the U.S. and Israel since October the 7th.
You know, there's two kinds of extremes, both in Washington and capitals around the world, I've noticed, that are trying to analyze this Iranian proxy network. And neither extreme is a helpful analogy to understand how this axis of resistance works. So if you'll permit me, I'll go wide and then we'll go specific.
Please.
Group A folks in Washington around the world believe that the relationship between patron and proxy is like this, that Iran just gets on the phone, immediately calls in the order, and there is zero local actor agency. The Houthis, the Iraqis, Lebanese Hezbollah have zero say, and they immediately implement what the Iranians want. That is one extreme that I don't believe is empirically borne out. The other extreme is an academic extreme born of the principal agent problem, that over time, the agent or the proxy gets more leverage over the principal because they're the ones who are risking their lives, they're the ones on the front lines, they're the ones who know the local terrain, they're the ones interacting with other local actors, and over time they get more leverage and they have the capability to keep saying no, no, no. Neither of these models is correct. The way Iran has built this axis of resistance is by creating and co-opting through that material support that we talked about local actors that share the same interests. So the Houthis are shooting at the same people the Islamic Republic wants to shoot at. Hamas in Gaza has been shooting at the same people that the Islamic Republic wants to shoot at. In fact, Iran's foray into the Levant, foray into Gaza, where the majority of the population is Sunni, is built on Hamas as well as Palestinian Islamic Jihad being a spoiler to the peace process and then being an even more aggressive and violent spoiler to the peace process after the Second Intifada. So the way these groups work is they have local interests and the Islamic Republic says, I can help you with those local interests, and then it co-opts that local interest through foreign material and political support. So the Houthis can set their own rate of fire, but they have the fire thanks to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And this is, of course, why it was actually quite hard for many in the intelligence community, many in the academic community, many in the analytical community to say, is there a smoking gun of Iranian support on October 7? You have all the Wall Street Journal sources with their local sources saying yes, and then you have Reuters with all their local sources saying no. And it just depends on your perspective and your understanding of how this proxy network works and which camp you will fall into.
That was Benenben Talablu, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Next, Krish Omara Vignaraja, president and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, talks about U.S. immigration policy and the asylum process.
Welcome back to Washington Journal. We're talking about U.S. immigration and asylum policy with our guest, Krish Omara Vignaraja. She's the president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Krish, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us about your work at the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, and especially as it relates to asylum services.
Sure. So Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service is the largest faith-based national nonprofit dedicated exclusively to serving refugees, asylum seekers, other vulnerable immigrants who have come to the U.S. We've operated for nearly 85 years in this work of service and advocacy. We've welcomed over 750,000 refugees and immigrants who live here in the United States. In terms of our work with asylum seekers, these are people who are exercising a legal right to seek asylum, fleeing war, persecution, violence. And so we help them in the immediate term in terms of room and board, helping them get to their final destination, trying to provide legal referrals so that they can have access and better understanding of how the system works.
And as far as funding goes, I know you take funding from donations, private donations from the public. What else?
Yeah, so our funding is really a public private partnership. So as a national resettlement agency, LIRS partners with the federal government. So we work with the Department of State as well as the Department of Health and Human Services. But also we rely on donations from a variety of private sources, philanthropic foundations, major corporations, and then, as you said, the generosity of everyday Americans.
And talking about the negotiations going on in the Senate, both Republicans and Democrats reportedly agree about tightening asylum standards. Can you tell us first what they are currently? How does the asylum system work right now? And what threshold do seekers need to meet?
Yeah, so the debates right now center around the standard for credible fear. So this has been a discussion that originated really decades ago as Congress essentially created, they created the expedited removal proceeding process that would allow people to be deported without a hearing before a judge. But to mitigate against the risk that people who have a legal right to come here to the U.S. Would be deported without any possibility of seeking that legal right, Congress created a credible fear interview to aid in, you know, a proper adjudication. So this is essentially a preliminary screening for people before they would be placed in removal proceedings. So during a credible fear interview, an asylum officer interviews the person to determine if there's what we call a significant possibility that they could kind of establish an asylum claim. Congress really intended the legal standard for credible fear interviews to be lower than what is required for the final grant of asylum, because the credible fear interview is just the preliminary stage. And so what's being debated right now is to really throw that system out the door and kind of what was behind congressional intent initially, because it would raise the legal standard to a more likely than not standard. And so in that way, it would actually contradict Congress's intent in creating the credible fear interview standard back in 1996.
And is there anything that the asylum seekers would need to prove? Are they required to show documentation? And then do they have, for instance, a lawyer with them, or how does that work?
Yeah, so essentially what they need to prove is that there is a credible fear that they have, experienced persecution as a result of their connection to one of five different categories. So it may be that they were politically persecuted. It could be that they were persecuted because of their religion. It could be that they were, persecuted because of their, social organizing. So they need to, in that interview, explain why it was that they were specifically targeted as individuals and why, if they were, returned, they would face a serious threat. And then after they meet that credible fear threshold, they do need to submit paperwork. And that will ultimately, if they do meet the credible fear and they are allowed to move forward with their legal proceeding, they will then go before an immigration judge and they'll have additional paperwork to kind of validate the claim.
And how long does that process usually take right now?
Yeah, so on average, it's about 4 years.
And in that 4 years, I'm assuming they're allowed to just stay in the United States.
Yeah. So, you know, so some number are not going to meet the credible fear threshold, and they will be put in expedited removal proceedings, and they will be deported. But for those who have met this test, they will be allowed to remain in the U.S. There is a decision that officers make of whether they'll go into immigration detention until their hearing or they'll be released. Knowing that, you know, we are talking about parents who are fleeing for their lives and to protect their children, you know, who do not pose any sort of national security risk. There is no reason to believe that we would, you know, fear their entry into, you know, U.S. communities. Those people are allowed to enter communities for a very, very small subset. And frankly, because this immigration detention has been set up and supported by Congress, there are some number of people who will go into immigration detention. Happy to talk more about that. But what we have shown is that there are better ways to manage immigrants that allow them to proceed legally, but that is actually far cheaper and still meets our immigration proceeding demands.
Krish, I'm going to show a short portion of Oklahoma Senator James Lankford. He's the lead Republican negotiator in the Senate border talks, and he was talking about this issue of asylum seekers being let into the country.
You cross the border on the southern border, those individuals are asking, quote unquote, for asylum. Asylum means I have fear in my home country and there's nowhere that I can go to get safety. Those people are saying the same thing that I hear from people over and over again when I'm at the border. I'm coming for opportunity. I'm coming for a job. I'm coming to be able to have a better life. That is not asylum. They don't qualify for asylum. But the Biden administration is not turning them around at the border and say you have to apply legally. You can't just literally cross in one day where we have no criminal background check, no information about their background or their history. Many of them, we don't even have documents. They just walk in and say what country they're from and say what their name is, and they come take on a brand new identity here in the United States. Everyone sees that as a national security risk, apparently other than Chuck Schumer. In the last 2 years, this White House has had 70,000 people they have designated as special interest aliens. These are individuals that are coming from Iran, from Iraq, from Pakistan, from areas of known terrorism that have been released into the country, literally unscreened, except are their names listed on our terror watch list. Otherwise, we have no criminal background history on them, have no idea. Those were released in the country, 70,000 just in the last 2 years. We've had almost 300 people that were picked up that were on the terror watch list just in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
So the threat is very real on this, and we should take it seriously.
Krish, your reaction to that?
I think it's important to understand that, you know, there is agreement that if you are seeking asylum, you ought to meet the threshold and the requirements for that. Economic migrants ought to come into the U.S. Through visa processes. Candidly, I think there's also bipartisan agreement that we need more visas for economic reasons. And frankly, we're undermining ourselves. You know, when we have about 9 million jobs that are unfilled and only 6 million unemployed Americans, there is a real opportunity for us to, you know, bring to fruition that win-win that immigration can be economically. That said, I think it's important to understand that for the people who are seeking asylum, sometimes people, you know, question, well, why are they coming to the southern border for that reason? They're only allowed to exercise their legal right to asylum if they are on American soil. And so that is why they are coming to the southern border. I know Senator Lankford kind of alludes to the suggestion that immigrants are dangerous to our communities. The reality is that the data does not prove that out. Whether you're talking about the southern border, where you find that by many metrics, they're actually safer, those 21 counties that are across the U.S. border compared to counties on the interior. So the idea that immigrants are coming, that they're seeking to perpetrate crimes, could not be farther from the truth. But the final point is, look, as an immigration advocate, I firmly believe that as a sovereign nation, we, of course, need to know who is coming across our border. We need to have the checks and balances to ensure that there is monitoring. fine. But that requires us to recognize that for three decades, we have had a dysfunctional immigration system. Why are Indians and Chinese coming to our southern border? Why do we have 20,000 Ukrainians come across the southern border? It was because other pathways had essentially been precluded because they are backlogged and they don't work. And that's where we need leadership. We don't need grandstanding to say what's not working. We need leaders to step up and say, here's how we're going to fix the problem. Because if we don't, we're actually undermining our own self-interest.
That was Krishamara Vignaraja, President and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website at cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.